This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Bharath Gowda from Databricks.
Thanks, Ian. My name is Bharath, as Ian mentioned, and I lead the product marketing function here at Databricks. Databricks is a company that was founded about 7-8 years ago. It was created by the original creators of Apache Spark, one of the most popular open source data processing framework out there. Since then, we have about 5,000 customers globally, more than 450 partners, and our mission is to drive data-driven innovation by really bringing together data engineering, data science, machine learning, as well as analytics in one platform.
We're seeing a lot more focus on analytics. We're seeing a lot more focus on the idea of AI in analytics, which makes sense because it takes advantage of the algorithms that sit beneath AI. But there comes a point where the amount of data we're trying to ingest, where the amount of results we're trying to understand becomes too much for people to cope. How do you begin to change that?
We have a fundamentally different view when we look at data as well as analytics you can do on top of it. We believe that both these functions need to be unified. There are a lot of systems out there that focus either on data or just on the analytics piece of it. Really, things like AI have been around for 30, 40 years now with respect to the different kind of algorithms. There have been a few fundamental changes in the last few years, maybe a decade or two, where cloud computing has come along, where you can process huge amounts of data. The data that's being created every day is actually enormous. And a combination of data as well as these existing algorithms and the cloud is actually making huge shifts in the marketplace. What we believe is that today, the biggest challenge that people face is not the analytics piece of it, but it's really the data management piece of it. Because data in the enterprise, not only in the enterprise, outside the enterprise that needs to be brought together, there's a huge amount of data coming in, but it is not ready for any kind of meaningful analytics. There's a lot of heavy lifting that needs to be done for the data to ensure that the data is surfaced to the right analytics team so that they can do the machine learning or the analytics on top of that and actually move it into a production system. That's what makes unique.
How do we change the way people are doing things? We've been doing ETL on data for 20, 30 years. And that's because much of our data, as you said just now, is in different sources, different locations. We're never going to really speed this up until we get rid of the whole ETL mentality and we actually start talking and mapping directly to the data sources, not duplicating them, but leaving them alone and then creating our working set from there. What needs to change?
Which is something I've been working on for a few years now. Because when Spark was first created, our goal was to have a unified processing layer irrespective of where the data existed. But as we were building Spark and we were making it a standard when it comes to big data processing, we realized that there were two fundamental things that Spark did not address that were kind of adjacent to what we were solving for. The first thing is that the existing data systems, and if you look at the evolution of data systems, you have the data warehouses that store the most pristine data sets, very rigid schemas, highly optimized for certain kinds of queries. And then in the last 10, 15 years, you've had the data lakes, where you can store all kinds of data, no schema, no performance, but it's a great place to store the data. As you mentioned, there's a lot of effort that needs to go from this data lake where you have like the messy data sets to the data warehouses before you can expose them to any kind of meaningful analytics. Two big problems. One is the data is like garbage in, garbage out. The data is really not reliable and not of higher quality. And if it is not, you can't do much with it. And the second thing is that when you have huge amounts of data, you want these queries to be running pretty efficiently. And even with Spark, they need a lot of expertise when it comes to management of the small files, how you structure the files, how you organize it and things like that. About a couple of years ago, we started to develop a new technology called Delta Lake. And we recently open sourced Delta Lake technology also. So Delta Lake addresses the two fundamental challenges that exist that we've been talking about. One is the quality issues, and the other is the performance issues.
Customers are still struggling with data cleanliness. How can we work off of dirtier data than people historically have tried?
Based on the kinds of analytics you want to do, you want different levels of data. So we call them different levels of data refinement. When you're doing machine learning, you're okay with actually having lots of data that has multiple dimensions. You don't need it to be as pristine as somebody looking at business reports for the last two quarters, what your revenue looked like or what your sales look like. The Delta Lake technology addresses those challenges by actually sitting on top of your existing data lake and bringing schema to the data lakes. So it creates a way where you can enforce a particular schema that the data going in has certain controls and certain expectations. Always, when the data goes into the lake, it's always clean. And the second thing that it does is also it ensures that you can set data expectations to ensure that whatever data you're actually putting in, you can enforce that through business rules. So you always have these data sets that are actually going from one form to the other. And we also implement what's called ACID transactions, which means that the data is never left in a corrupt state. These problems alleviate the challenges of ETL pipelines and building the complexity. But as soon as the data gets to the data lake, it is ready for meaningful analytics right off the gate.
So does that mean you've managed to force a change of culture amongst your customers? Because historically, the idea of data ownership, data control, data cleanliness was an IT issue. But actually, it's not an IT issue. Most of the problem comes in the way data is input. Yes, there will be system errors, but incomplete records, users not finishing what they're doing, customers providing the input people with the wrong data, and therefore not having the right way of cleaning that data. Are your customers now saying that it's everybody's responsibility to get that data clean from the beginning, or are they doing something else?
What we're telling our customers is that you need to take a layered approach to data. So when the data comes in, you can still put all your raw data in a place as is, but then as you're doing the transformations, you already know who are the different data science teams you have, what are the kinds of data sets they need, what kind of problems are actually solving it. So you need to build a data architecture that allows them to go from raw data sets to the next level. Maybe you call them the bronze data, then the silver, then the gold. But at each level, you should be able to do some kind of analytics or machine learning on it. And you should be able to maintain all these things in a consistent manner all the time. Because to the problem that you mentioned at the beginning of this discussion is that it is not so much about ensuring that the data is ready, but it's about making it ready all through that journey so that you don't have to go back and clean the data sets every 2 months or 3 months. And that we've implemented through things like ACID transactions, things like that existed in the database world. We've brought those things to the data lake world.
One of the other challenges that people had with analytics still do in a lot of environments is cost. It's not simply a case of I'm going to connect to that data point over there or that data or that data. First of all, you've got to have an integration to connect to it. You've got to be able to extract that data in a way you want. Secondly, in many cases, you've got to have the licenses to be able to do this. A lot of organizations buy into very expensive analytic solutions, but they buy one or two seats. They assume that those will be owned purely simply by the data scientists, and what then will come out of that is a set of quick routines that the users can run in a much more restricted license. It inhibits the take-up of a lot of software and a lot of analytics work. You're an open source-based company. How does licensing change?
Our fundamental approach is to drive the different kinds of analytics in one unified way. That's the ultimate goal. So we don't want to restrict people from with respect to the number of users they have. We want to expose the data sets that exist in these companies and truly unlock the value of that. So the value that comes is actually based on the kind of processing you're doing. So our licensing model is completely based on what kind of processing you do, irrespective of whether you have 10 people using it or thousands of people using it. And also the kinds of processing you do could be automated workloads like running production jobs, which have a different value point because the value is different compared to you doing interactive stuff on the same platform. That's how we do it.
People don't really know what part of the license they need. Do they need a full workbench per user? Do they need just really a read license for other bunches of users? How do you walk customers through understanding the mix of licensing that they need?
The approach that we have taken is that we believe that companies today, the single biggest asset beyond the people that they have is data. So our primary principle when it comes to how we are running Databricks is to make sure that you unlock the value from the data, not with respect to the number of people and whatnot. It is also not even dependent on the kinds of use cases you have on top of that. It just depends on how much processing you do. So we have one platform. We price customers based on how the platform gets used. So they get all the features of the platform as part of one package.
You're cloud-based. One of the challenges with cloud-based software is we're very quick to say people pay for what you use, which sounds really good because I can ramp up my software tomorrow morning. But if that user only uses that software for 15 minutes, I don't get charged for just 15 minutes. Most licensing packages say, well, you know, we're pricing by the day or the week or the month per user. How do you actually make software licensing from a cloud perspective match hardware licensing from a cloud perspective? Because if I ramp up my CPU and my memory and then I turn it off, I stop paying at that moment.
Especially in the world of big data, analytics, and machine learning, you could have processes that run amok very quickly. There are lots of different users who are using these things. An enterprise platform where you have thousands of people using these things across multiple business units, you need to make sure that the DevOps teams, the administrators are actually setting them up. They have the kinds of cost controls. They have the visibility towards who is using what, actually provision these things the right way. So we have both in the context of the capabilities that actually support that kind of monitoring of cost as well as secure access to who gets to set up clusters, how much of these clusters they can use and things like that. But on the other end, more and more, we want to give to our customers more and more granular controls on pricing also. So we don't charge by the day, we don't charge by the month, we actually charge by the second for a lot of capabilities. We also have implemented features like auto-scaling, and also we turn off machines when they're actually dormant, and there's a lot more innovation that we're bringing to the table when it comes to infrastructure management.
If we look at old-school database technology, where we were charging business units for its access, we actually had estimation routines that would tell us how much this job was going to cost or how much resource this job would require. We don't tend to see that in cloud, and that becomes important because with cloud, users are unrestricted in the size of query they can run. So they don't necessarily know how much resource this query is going to consume or how long this query or related queries are going to do. They simply fire, forget, fire, forget, fire, forget, because their machine doesn't lock up for the first one. So let's have 10, 20, 30. Can you make it easy for people to truly understand what the potential cost is of what they're doing?
We do have capabilities within the software that lets you understand some of these things. But a lot of this is also around policies that the customers themselves have within their organizations. So there's a business reason why you need this kind of elasticity. There's also a reason where you're doing something in development, you don't need access to these big clusters. When we talk about our solution and broader data teams, we talk about data scientists who shouldn't have to worry about infrastructure, but the data science team, if you will, has to work with the infrastructure team to understand what kinds of clusters they need, what constraints need to be established to make sure that they can be provisioned, but there are also controls where things just turn off after a certain point. There are both cultural ways from a policy standpoint, as well as monitoring and estimating these things that are part of the product portfolio.
One of the big challenges we have with data at the moment, and the bigger our analytics sets get, the bigger this problem gets, is we very quickly discover that we're using PII. We start, perhaps, with a whole bunch of anonymized data. Yet when we turn round, that analytics has removed the anonymity, and now we have to start thinking about where's the data located? What is the data telling us? Do we actually have a compliance issue here? How do you begin to build rules and controls when you are a massive, complex, AI-based data analytics solution compared to somebody sitting there with access on their desktop?
Part of the challenge that our customers face in the older, antiquated data architecture is that they're constantly maintaining multiple copies of data. And you make multiple copies of data, it's almost impossible to figure out, hey, what kind of information do I have about Ian? What are the systems that I need to go search for? It could be 10, 20, 30 different systems. The other big challenge with respect to data lakes is that you cannot update the information. You cannot search and just update specific records because of the volume and how these data lakes are constructed. So we solved for it by two specific things that we did as part of the Delta Lake technology. One is you can look for a needle in a haystack. You can go back and update just the records that Ian has, just delete his record, which is super important when it comes to GDPR. So you need to be able to service those data subject requests really quickly. It is almost impossible to do that in the world where you have 50, 60 different data systems across multiple data lakes and multiple ETL storage systems. So we address that through our product capability. That's one. And the second thing is that we create a much simpler data architecture where the data is stored in one place.
I'd like to return to the issue of pricing and survivability here. Because one of the things we're seeing is the days of small projects in open source that appear, survive for a period of time, and grow slowly has long gone. Any successful open source project now immediately looks for somebody to help monetize it. We're here at DevOps World, recording on the side of that, where CloudBees has taken on Jenkins and a whole bunch of other projects and has provided that commercial impetus. We've seen IBM acquire Red Hat. As we were talking beforehand, I suggested that one of the things that we think at Enterprise Times and at Synonym Advisory is we may well see SAP make a bid for SUSE. How does the survivability of the existing open source pricing work as we look forward?
There's a broader question there. You know, when you think about open source technologies, it is very important to be true to the open source ecosystem, the community, building software that is actually sustainable and actually useful to the broader community. And you have to marry that with the business constructs of building a business that actually is sustainable. The approach that we have taken for these things is that open source has to remain open, which means that everybody should be able to contribute to that open source, and people should be able to use the core open source technology and extend it. The approach that we have taken is that taking that open source capability and running that as an enterprise-based cloud service. That is the value that we bring to the enterprise companies. The other thing that is unique about our approach is that it's not just about running a single open source project, but it's about solving a business problem. When you look at the broader open source technologies, there are companies that are based just on one open source technology. So it's almost like we have this technology and I'm going to monetize that. Technologies come and go. What remains is the business problem or the technical problem, and the new technologies that come out either that remove the problem completely or they leapfrog that thing. So our focus is to continue to work in the open source ecosystem and continue to build open source software, but then focus on the problems that the collection of open source actually solves and solving that for the enterprises in a seamless manner. Which is why when you talk about Spark and Delta Lake and MLflow, all these adjacent technologies that are super relevant in the world of data, machine learning, as well as analytics, and we wanted to make it really easy for enterprises to actually use all these things in a reliable fashion.
One of the core tenets of open source and commercialization of it is that whatever the commercialization arm creates has to come back to the open source. It has to recognize the contribution of the open source community, which is not always the case out there when we look around the market. How difficult is it working across what is effectively multiple open source technologies to take your own development and say, well, hang on, this applies to this project, we must push this bit back today to there, this applies to multiple projects, let's push it to everybody, but at the same time, still recognize what's changing at those local levels?
At the core, each one of these open source projects solve a particular problem for a particular kind of practitioner. From the beginning, as a design principle, we make sure that we're solving the full problem for them. But now when you take that solution and you have to make it work specifically in different environments, that calls for deeper integrations to be built. And those integrations, in a lot of cases, it is not possible to make it open source technology because a lot of those integrations are constantly changing with respect to the different things that are changing on the other side of the fence. And then we want to make sure that the problem that we're solving for with that specific technology is not being interfered by some adjacent things that need to work with it. So for instance, Delta Lake working with MLflow. We believe so the Delta Lake technology, we've implemented specific things on the MLflow side so that you can actually use Delta Lake in a specific way. That is more on the MLflow side of the house to make sure that these integrations work really well. But there will come a point where we're constantly looking at these things, and as long as we can make these things open interfaces, we will definitely look to open source more and more of these things.
As we look forward, and we take yourselves as a good example as almost effectively an aggregator of open source technologies, do you see the future shifting? In the past, it was large software companies who built monolithic empires. Then lots of small, very agile open source companies, and now companies like yourself who are pulling from multiple open source projects. What is the future going forward of that match of open source versus commercial?
Open source will continue to dominate because open source is probably one of the best ways to build harder technology that people care about. And while that continues to dominate, the enterprises who want to use these open source technologies want a different level of experience when they use these technologies. When you're using open source technologies that are smaller point solutions, that is very different from what you need to do from a data analytics and machine learning stack, which is core to your comparative advantage. So the level of service they need, the level of integrations they need, because time to market is critical for these companies. So those kinds of value attributes are what businesses will actually pay for. So it's the happy marriage between those two things that will continue to drive.
We struggle with skills across so many different areas of software at the moment. How are you finding the skills market around ML and AI?
That's probably the hottest thing out there. Every developer, every engineer today, or every person actually wants to do something on the machine learning side of the house. For us, we still continue to work on both sides of the fence, both on the data side, the systems engineering side, building really, really highly reliable distributed systems in the cloud, which also requires like really, really solid software engineering skills. And then finally, on the machine learning side as well.
We've seen major banks turn around and say every employee has to be able to write code. And that's because they want these employees writing analytics code to find the information they need to do their job. Is it really sustainable that every employee will end up writing code for what they do? Or do we need to do a better job in making the code that we write more usable in terms of the way it's presented?
It's hard to say what's going to happen 20, 30 years from now. Maybe everybody is going to be writing code of some sort. But the way I look at it is companies need to be more data-driven. And to be data-driven doesn't mean you have to write code. You should be able to consume code, you know, frame the hypothesis. I think this will continue to be a team sport. There will be people who understand the domain really well, their business domain, and there will be engineers who can actually build and implement hardened systems. In the middle of all that, you need ML engineers and data scientists to help understand, you know, the data and, you know, build the algorithms and stitch everything together. I think it's going to be multiple skills, multiple groups of people who together have to be productive and help organizations be data-driven.
I'm often reminded in this industry of things that we should never say. When object orientation appeared in 1988, companies said, oh, don't worry about software developers. Each company will have one or two and everybody else will assemble the code. How wrong they were. Bharath, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ian.